The desire to create is one of the deepest yearnings of the human soul. We each have an inherent wish to create something that did not exist before. The more you trust and rely upon the Spirit, the greater your capacity to create.
I'm Nancy Hansen, and this is Everything Creative. This program explores a wide range of creative ideas, talents, and experiences through interviews and group discussions. Today, professor and Egyptologist Carrie Milstein interviews NBA player Mark Madsen.
Hi, and welcome back to Everything Creative. I'm Carrie Milstein, and this week we're here with Mark Madsen, a 6'9" power forward currently for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Hi, Mark.
Carrie, great to be with you again. It's been a long time.
It has been. It's good to be with you. Why don't you start out, Mark, by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you got into basketball, all that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in Northern California in Danville, which is just a little bit east of Oakland. And my first introduction to basketball was basically playing with my dad. He started out by playing catch with me with the basketball. You know, some dads go out and play catch with the baseball. We were playing catch with the basketball. And then it evolved into playing one-on-one every single night, really until high school.
With your dad?
With my dad, yeah.
Now, you know, you have a fairly good-sized family, don't you?
I'm the fifth out of 10 kids. And I used to always enjoy playing with him. And one night, I think I was a eighth grader or a freshman in high school, I broke his rib. And so that stopped the one-on-one games.
And then from there, you played high school, I assume?
Yeah, I played high school at Santa Monica High School in Danville. And then I served my mission after that. And then I went to Stanford and I played at Stanford.
I remember you at Stanford. You had a good career there. And then?
And after Stanford, you know, I was kind of at the point where I was trying to figure out if I could play at the next level. And it just kind of worked out to where, you know, when you're getting ready to try out for the NBA, it's very intense. You fly to 10 or 15 different teams. They put you through all kinds of psychological tests, put you through physical tests. They bring in the best players and you play against each other, and sometimes fights break out. So I went through this whole process, and then the draft happens, and I got drafted by the Lakers, played there for 3 years. And then I thought I was going to stay in LA, but Karl Malone of the Jazz said publicly, you know, he said, I want to come to LA. So when Karl Malone went to LA, my general manager called me and said, hey, go out and look for a new job.
too many power forwards in one place.
Yeah.
All right. And what teams did you try out with?
Well, so before the draft, I tried out with Sacramento Kings, the Lakers, Houston Rockets, a handful of others. But then when I was a free agent after the Lakers, that is less of a tryout and more of a, you know, the teams know you. They've watched you for 3 years. And
you're a known commodity.
Yeah, exactly. So that was Dallas and Minnesota. I chose Minnesota.
All right. And you were with Lakers during some championship years.
I was very fortunate. You know, I was there during two out of the three championships. And it was an experience that, you know, I came straight into that. And I didn't realize how lucky I was, because now I've been on one of the worst teams in the NBA recently in Minnesota. And so I've seen both ends of the spectrum.
Right. Well, good. Let's talk about some of the things that are different or creative about playing in the NBA. First of all, I mean, it's not your normal 9-to-5 job. Tell us just a little bit about how life might be different for you there than elsewhere.
Well, what people probably don't see about the NBA is most NBA players spend a good chunk of their day asleep in bed, because, you know, we're flying places in the middle of the night, getting into places at 4 in the morning, a game the next day. So if you try to do too much, you'll get sick. And so most guys are asleep in bed a lot. You have time to read. You have time to think about the game. And it's pretty busy.
So you have to be creative just to begin with your schedule.
I guess.
Yeah. Well, good. Now, I have to – I don't know when you got this nickname, if it was in Stanford or not, but at least when you were with the Lakers, and I lived in Los Angeles at the time, you were known as Mad Dog Madsen. And I think that that nickname has stuck with you. How did that come about?
In fifth grade, my PE teacher just came up with it one day, because I played hard. And so it kind of stuck with me. And to this day, you know, people all around the NBA, they don't call me Mark. They call me Mad Dog.
From fifth grade on.
From fifth grade on. You know, they either call me Mad Dog or just Dog or Big Dog. And so it's funny, you know, at home with my family, they all call me Mark. And everywhere else, people call me, you know, Mad Dog.
So that's funny. I didn't realize it was for that long.
Yeah.
Now, I can understand how it really stuck in Los Angeles. I mean, you were famous there as one of the more colorful characters with the team, known for your excitement and, you know, you'd scream when you dunked and the famous – you better tell us a little bit more about the famous dance and so on. But and then maybe you can go from there to talk about – I mean, I think you're known as just kind of a creative, colorful personality. At least you were in Los Angeles.
Well, you know, the you mentioned the dancing incident, and so I figure I should shed a little bit of light on that. I'd like to see you dance, Kerry. I think that you'd probably be a lot better than me.
No, my wife will tell you it's not true.
What happened with the dance was simply that we had just won a championship, and Shaq was giving a little speech, and he decided to debut a new rap song that I think he had written himself. And so he starts singing this new rap song, and then everyone on my team runs down to the stage and starts dancing around. And so, you know, I'm not a dancer, but I thought, hey, everyone's dancing. I'll go down and dance too. And so I went down and danced, and I guess I was the uncoordinated one. And, you know, that's what happened.
Somehow you became famous. Everyone wanted you to dance in parades and everything after that. But just tell about how you make life fun. You seem to enliven your teams and keep everyone happy. And I'm sure there's a complex dynamic in all of the people that are a lot of egos and so on in a team. But you seem to work and keep everyone happy and on the light side. And I think that's one of the things that's impressed me about you. And I think that's a creative talent that you have.
Well, I appreciate it, Kerry. It's playing in the NBA, I think probably in any walk of life. You know, we all run across people that are incredibly humble. We run across people that have a very large ego, both. I think in the NBA, some players, part of what makes them good is a huge self-belief. Bigger than you can even imagine, almost. Some of the greatest players have this huge belief in self to where they literally believe they can do anything. And so that makes for the same thing that makes them so great at with their gift can also at times be candidly somewhat abrasive, you know, and somewhat you don't know how to deal with it sometimes. And so that has been one of the biggest, I mean, that is something I'm really happy that I've seen, because as strong of a personality as some of these guys have, they're all such great guys. And I remember a specific incident. One time in L.A., we had just lost the game in Houston. And our coach, Phil Jackson, came into the locker room and said, okay, guys, we just lost the game because, you know, and he mentioned one of the guys on the team. He said, you know, you're out late. You're with your family. You're with your friends. You have ties to Houston, you know. We're going to have to fly in the day of the game instead of the night before. And the player was so upset, he grabbed something in his hand and threw it at the TV, trying to shatter the TV. And the player was so upset that the coach had called him out publicly and blamed the loss on his family. And so the next day, our coach comes in, Phil Jackson. He basically said, hey, look, I have been asked contractually to do a job. One of the things that makes you guys good in this room is you have a strong will. And he said, but I have to have a strong will too, because if I don't, you guys are going to walk all over me. And that incident right there, it was a great learning lesson in the fact that you can all learn to work together no matter what people are thinking or feeling.
Good. Now, Phil Jackson is known as one of the more creative coaches in the NBA in a variety of ways. What was it like to work with him?
You know, it was unlike any experience or any coach I've ever known. You know, he would come in before playoff games and wave like some kind of incense. You know, I've never smoked marijuana, but I do know what it smelled like. The incense smelled a little bit like marijuana, okay? It wasn't, but he would burn the incense in the locker room. You know, one thing about Phil that when we talk about creativity, one of his greatest, and he is a great coach, a great man, and knows a lot about the game, but one thing where he exudes creativity is that he puts a system in place for the players, and he asks the players to use your own innate abilities and your own creative instincts on the court. And so he, in a sense, empowers players to be creative on the court, which makes it fun. It makes it – sometimes I think it makes you better. Sometimes it makes you worse. But it's way better than other coaches who basically make you a robot. They say, go out there and run this play, and the coach wants to legislate every single pass. Because when you do that, you turn into a robot, and there's no creative juices. There's no improvisation, and there's no spice to the game.
Ah, great insight. That takes me kind of where I was hoping we'd go, and that's that in basketball or any sporting event, you have rules, you have guidelines, and you have systems, and yet those who are great are usually working both in and out of the system. You seem to be talking about that a little bit. How does that work for you, and how do you see that working for other players?
You know, that's a great observation, Kerry, because, you know, it really is true. In basketball especially, you have got to be able to work within the system and without the system. And one of the greatest players that finds a good balance, in my opinion, is Kobe Bryant. Played with him 3 years. And you've watched him play many times in person, live at the Staples Center. But Kobe works within the system through much of the game in involving his teammates, trying to make a dunk for one of his teammates, trying to get a teammate a wide-open jumper. But then there are times in the game where he's you know, in rhythm, feeling it, whatever you want to say, where he goes outside of the system. And Phil is okay with that, Phil Jackson. Where Phil, the tug and pull between Phil and Kobe was always, Kobe, go outside of the system, but don't do it too much. Right. And so that's the balance that they have really found a nice equilibrium on.
How about for you personally, working in the system and yet your own excitement and the way you'd like to improv and so on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know, you know, the listeners come from a lot of this program, come from all kinds of different areas of life. But for me personally, I've never been as creative of a basketball player as with Phil Jackson. He came to me one day. He said, you have guard skills, meaning I can dribble, I can pass, I can see the floor. I mean, he would always add to that, but you can't shoot worth a lick. You know, but he let me explore the guard skills. And the game, it helped our team a little bit. And it made it so much more fun. It made the game so fun. And so I think part of creativity is allowing other people to be creative.
And then usually you're better when you're having fun and enjoying and pushing your own boundaries.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Huh. Well, great. How about with the Timberwolves? Do you feel like you're given – or maybe that's too tough of a question to answer right now.
You know, there have been – actually, with the Timberwolves recently, I haven't played quite as much. But, you know, Kevin McHale, our current coach – he's creative in the sense that he'll come into practice every day and it'll be different many, many days. So he'll have creative practices and that makes it fun for players. You know, some coaches do the same thing every single day. Players start dreading coming into practice. One day McHale came in, he said, okay, if we make a half-court shot, no practice today. So guys were sprinting to the ball rack, throwing it, trying to make half-court shots. We made it and we got the day off. He's okay, go home, have a good day.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Now, how about you? How do you personally get ready for a game? And I'm sure you get some things from the team about how you should prepare and what your strategy should be, but I would guess you do some of that on your own as well.
The best thing I've ever done from the times of my career when I played a lot is, you know, during games when it really mattered in the playoffs, honestly, it's going to sound cliche, but I would go home before the game. We had practice in the morning. You go home. You know, you eat a meal, you relax, you make a few phone calls, and then you rest and you think about the game. And I would really try to visualize things happening during the game with me being aggressive, with me being assertive, and with me not being passive or timid or afraid of trying things on the court. And so I try to visualize, you know, you can't visualize other people, but you can visualize yourself and how you're going to help the team. And I try to do that by visualization of being aggressive.
Yeah. Now, I was going to ask also, you've played with some of the more dynamic personalities in the league and with some of the better players, Kevin Garnett, Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant. What are some of the things you've learned from each of them about how they personally work that maybe you've been able to adopt and how they prepare? And then maybe a little later we can talk about some of the fun things that you've done with them.
But. Well, let's start with Kobe. You know, Kobe, I've never met a player that has a stronger will to win than Kobe. And one of the great things that Kobe did is he really challenged his teammates around him. You know, some players, if you're not playing well, they'll get exasperated. You know, if they're not playing well, no one says anything to them. But with Kobe, if you weren't playing well, he would come up to you and he would say, I need more out of you. You know, and he would say it sometimes forcefully, sometimes really nice, sometimes with a joke. But he held you accountable. You know, Shaq was the same. You know, Shaq would really hold you accountable. I'll never forget, Shaq came up to me before my first playoff start. And he pulled me aside. He said, don't try to do too much. Don't try to do too little. And it's an interesting thing to say, you know, but it was really insightful because it made me realize that he needed me to do something. Mm-hmm. I couldn't fade away and just let everyone else carry the load, but I couldn't try to do everything myself. And then, you know, Kevin Garnett has to be one of the best communicators I've played with. On SportsCenter last year, there was an incident where he really got into one of his teammates and his teammates started crying during a game, and ESPN picked up on it.
Right.
And so everyone was like, well, how can a grown man cry and all this stuff? And look, I've seen a lot of grown men cry in the NBA for a lot of different reasons, all kinds of things. So I don't have a problem with crying. But, you know, they approached Kevin after the game. They said, you know, he was really broken up. The player that you addressed was, you know, broken up. And what are you going to do now? And Kevin said, you know, I'm going to go back to the locker room and I'm going to really break it down and get real with this certain player, meaning he was going to try to talk out whatever issue there was, you know, and make things whole and make things right. And I've always really respected that about Kevin, that the aspect of communication and talking about things that are hard to talk about.
Yeah. Good. Well, how about preparing for the game? Have you learned, the things that you have to come up with on your own, you have the system we've talked about, but the things you have to come up with on your own to make yourself a better player, what have you developed for yourself and what have you picked up from others?
You know, I've watched a lot of different players and everyone does something different before the games, but most guys stick to their own unique routine. You know, for me, I'm a player, I have no routine. You know, my routine is go out onto the court, get a feel for the atmosphere, talk to some fans, try to get myself feeling comfortable, shoot a few times, laugh and joke with my teammates, and then go in and rest for the game. You know, so mine's a pretty simple pregame routine.
All right. Now, I know that you and Shaquille had a special relationship when you were in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
He's one of the more, I mean, he's tried all sorts of creative things, but just fun-loving people. And why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, Shaq has a great personality. And, I don't know if you're, are you on Twitter, Ken?
No, I'm technologically not advanced enough for that.
But. Okay. Well, Shaq was one of the first people on Twitter. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to follow Shaq's Twitter account. So I got a Twitter account and I started following Shaq's. And it is one of the most fun things to follow. He puts an update one day and I read it. It says, here at a such and such a restaurant in Portland, the first person to touch me gets two great tickets to the Portland game. Okay. So then a couple minutes later, it says, still no one here. And then he says, a few minutes later, we have a winner. Then 5 minutes later, he says, wow, 100 people showed up. I have to buy a lot of tickets now. And so Shaq, he has a great sense of humor. He's really a great human being. You know, I saw Shaq a week ago. He said to me, you married yet? I said, not yet. He said, well, let me know when it is. I'm coming to the wedding. He said, make sure it's in the summertime because I'm coming. And the funny thing, he said that to me 4 times in a row, the last 4 times I've seen him. So I hope he comes, but we'll see.
I remember when you first got to L.A., the kind of famous relationship was with you and Shaq was everywhere he went, he was looking for a Mormon girl to set you up with.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up. I show up to a game one night, and the vice president, well, an executive for the Lakers comes up to me and says, dude, so I get the funniest phone call last night. He said, I'm sitting at the house and my phone rings and it's my buddy who's at a restaurant in Marina Del Rey. And my buddy said that Shaq came in and was asking various girls if they were Mormon. And he said, because if you are Mormon, I've got a great guy to set you up with. And I'm sitting there listening to this and I just thought it was funny. And you know, it shows Shaq's love of life, you know. And, you know, I remember being on the plane one time when Shaq and a flight attendant walked by and he said, "Excuse me, are you Mormon? Because if you are, I got a good guy for you." And he points over to me. So he has fun with things. You know, he knew I was LDS. He knows specific things about other players, and he really is able to get to know people for the things that make them the person they are.
Right. How did LDS, being LDS or Mormon, interact or affect your relationship with other players or life in the NBA?
You know, it's been interesting. Most guys in the NBA come from such different backgrounds, and the NBA is a very accepting place of differences. And so many of my teammates have been very respectful of my faith and of, you know, the values and standards of the LDS faith. You know, many have been indifferent, kind of like, hey, it works for you, do it. You know, some have been curious. I would say in all the years I've been playing, I've had one negative comment. And truthfully, when the comment was made, you know, you listen to General Conference and you listen to great inspirational stories. And, you know, it seems that some people always know exactly how to respond when, you know, something negative gets said about the church or a certain aspect of our faith or something. And, you know, something negative got said and I didn't know how to react, you know. And that was a learning experience in and of itself, because I love my faith very deeply. I love being LDS. And so that was a learning experience in the sense of, hey, if someone does come to you with something shocking or negative or impulsive, be ready to respond. You know, be prepared to respond. You can't – I didn't want to allow myself to be shell-shocked, whether it's about my faith or about anything else. You know, I don't want to ever allow myself to be shell-shocked in a situation where a response is warranted.
Good. Well said. I remember – I imagine that you have to find sometimes your own way of being able to worship on the Sabbath or something. I still remember that I always knew when we both lived in Los Angeles, I always knew when the Lakers were playing a home afternoon game, because your ward met at 1 o'clock and mine at 9. And if I saw you in my sacrament meeting, I knew you were there because you were going to be playing later and you couldn't go to your ward. But talk about how you kind of make things work on the road.
You know, I really try to find an LDS church. I go to Mormon.org and I try. It doesn't always work out, but, you know, in general, I really try. And sometimes with our travel schedule, it doesn't always work. Yeah. But I remember I was in New Orleans 3 months ago, and there was time. There was a window for me to go to church. And so I looked up on Mormon.org. It was a long ways away, the church building. I got a taxi, went out there, and the taxi pulled up to this building, and it was totally under construction. Must have been being repaired from the hurricane.
Right.
And I was so sad inside because I had just been in the taxi like 45 minutes. And so I said, just take me back to the hotel. And I got back and I sent an email to Mormon.org and I said, hey, look, I said, you guys do a great job. I love it. But if you can update it so that you have the chapels under construction too, that would be great. So.
That's great. Now, you mentioned a moment ago about Shaq being on Twitter and so on. I know that you're popular with a lot of fans and that you find ways to interact with them. I think you're very creative in the different things you do. Right. Talk about some of the things you do to interact with fans.
Well, the biggest thing is I do have a Twitter account, but I write a blog.
Now, tell me what a Twitter account is.
Twitter, you know, I actually wrote a blog posting about Twitter, Kerry. But
if I read your blog, I'd know about Twitter. All right.
Just kidding. Twitter is one of those things. You write down what you're thinking about and what you're feeling in 140 characters or less, okay? Mm. So where's the value in that?
Well, and it's done online, though.
It's done online.
Okay.
And it's most of it is publicly accessible. If you say publicly accessible, anyone can read it.
Okay.
So you write about where does the value come from? Well, it's interesting. When the plane crash in the Hudson River happened, the most accurate, up-to-date, and deep information came from people's Twitter accounts.
Really?
Because they said, oh, I just saw a plane. Somebody, I think, posted a photo. So it was real-time information about a world event, a catastrophe that had just happened.
Wow.
You know, and so I took that to the next level, and I wanted to figure out what people were thinking and feeling about the stimulus package. So I typed in stimulus package into search.twitter.com. You literally see a real-time feed of anyone who has mentioned the word stimulus package in their update.
Huh.
So it is a way of just figuring out what people are thinking and feeling. And if someone's interested in knowing what I'm saying about basketball, they can, you know, tune in.
Fun. And you do a blog as well, right?
I do a blog as well. The blog is meant to be fun. You know, I try to keep it really fun, interesting. I don't want to bore people. You know, one of my teammates, Irvin Johnson, not Magic, but a different Irvin Johnson, came into the locker room one day. He said, 365 days a year is too many days to be serious. We got to laugh and joke. And it was such a good point. And so I try to have things on my blog that will make people laugh and joke.
And is your blog, is it a personal thing or is it through NBA.com?
It's actually at markmadsen.com /blog.
Ah, so now that brings up another thing, the markmadsen.com. I know your degree was in Stanford, which is a good school, and was in economics, which I think is a tough field. But you've always kept up that business interest, and for as long as I've known you, you've been exploring different ideas for business, which I think is one of the most creatively demanding things in the world, to try and come up with different businesses that are viable. And I know some of what you do is with domain names, but I think there's some other things as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, we, you know, I'm passionate about communication in a way, you know, and actually, you know, I've got a domain name for you, Egyptologist.com.
Yeah.
That I picked up, and we've talked about it, and I'm really excited when the time is appropriate for you to have this outlet where you can share all of your expertise about Egyptology, because I've learned so much from you in L.A. at the Institute, in our one-on-one discussions, and I think it'd be a resource not only to members of this church that we belong to, but of many other churches, people of no church, people of archaeological interest, to follow your expertise. And so in a way, by understanding domain names, you can – it's a way of helping people find information that they're looking for. You know, in fact, I'm helping my mom build a website. She is an expert gardener. She loves gardening. And she and my dad attend lectures in Utah. They came to Minnesota for the hazelnut festival of the world. And they love agriculture. And so she enjoys writing. So I helped her build a website. It's just a fun way to exchange information and ideas.
Right. Right. And so are you trying to make that a little bit of a business as well? Or
I mean, I would – you know, I would much rather help people get good information. I mean, I have made investments in certain aspects of this business. And so, you know, you want to see a positive return. And that definitely is part of any business. But there's also an element of course, wanting to realize a positive return on the investment. And, of course, that's natural in any business. But when you can share good, positive information broadly, it's gratifying.
Oh, and I mean, as I've said before, I'm involved with an excavation, and the gift of the domain name is actually going to be, we're desperately trying to raise funding, and you've given this as a gift. That's a wonderful thing, and I think that represents the kind of thing you are typically trying to do.
Well, I mean, for me, Kerry, it's like, you know, my dad loves archaeology, and so I grew up with that. He took us down to Peru one time, and you know, he was using his Spanish, and he found a guy that had an ancient, you know, figurine that he said he had dug up from behind a hill. He pointed up. So, you know, my dad bought this figurine thinking it was authentic and took it home, and it sat on a shelf. And then one day we had an archaeology friend come over to the house. My dad said, this is one of my prized pieces. The guy looked at it and said, oh, this is fake.
Yeah.
and so when I see your expertise – and the types of things, just even that you and I were talking about here in the lobby, about the pyramids and the, you know, I know the information is private, so I'm not going to publicly disclose it. That's for you and your thesis and your piece that you eventually get published. But these are fascinating things for me. And so I'm so excited to hear more about them.
I appreciate that. But that kind of, it's almost a giving, I hate to sound too sappy, but a giving nature, and you're always looking for ways to do things. To me, that's where I see maybe some of your most creative expressions. I know you go around and do things with high schools and so on. Tell us about that.
Well, I've done some various basketball camps in Minnesota recently. And, you know, we rent out the gym from the high school, and we open it up for the youth in the area. You know, it is a paid camp, and so kids, you know, I want them to feel like there's a level of commitment, so they come every day. But I wanted to make it a great experience for them, a fun experience, and so we bring in some great camp counselors. I actually go around throughout the whole NBA season, and I ask the superstar players for a signed pair of shoes.
Oh, really?
And so this last year, you know, I don't know Dwayne Wade, but one of the ball boys, I said, hey, can you approach Dwayne after the game and just tell him, say, hey, look, you know, Mark Madsen says he doesn't know you that well, but would you please donate a signed pair of Dwayne Wade shoes for him to then give out his camp to kids? And Dwayne, he did it, you know, and Tim Duncan was kind enough to send a pair. You know, it's interesting with Tim, you know, we almost got into a fight 2 years ago. And, you know, I'm fine getting hit in the head and all kinds of stuff. And I'm fine delivering a blow on the court. But my emotions got the best of me this game. And there was an incident that happened earlier in the game, not with Tim, but with a different player. I was very out of sorts, very upset. And so I hit Tim really hard. And he knew that was not a basketball hit. That was, and so there's some words were exchanged. And, you know, we talked about it later. And we got on the same page. And I was happy because that's not me. But I did it. But that wasn't me at my best. And he let it go. He said, you know what, hey, no big deal. Let's move on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's good that gave me a lot of, that made me happy that we could put that incident behind us.
Oh, good. And then he sent you the shoes for the...
A year later. So yeah, we had a year-long cool-off period. but he was kind enough to send me the shoes. And, yeah, it shows what type of guy he is. You know, he's not a guy that's going to hold a grudge.
Right. So what kind of things do you do at the camp, and what kind of kids come?
You know, a wide variety of kids from Minnesota. The camp is in Minnesota this year. You know, I want it to be something fun. I want them to learn a lot about basketball. I want the kids to gain new skills. The biggest thing, though, is I want the kids to have fun and be challenged. And you know, that's my philosophy. You know, I'm not trying to make this a military camp where we scream and yell. I want it to be a great memory where we talk about some positive things. I share some very real experiences with the kids about stupid stuff I've done, good stuff I've done, good stuff teammates have done, and to try to keep it real. You know, that's an expression that gets used in the basketball community. The hip-hop community almost goes hand-in-hand with the basketball community. And keep it real is a big phrase. And so I try to keep things very real. You know, and hopefully share some things that the kids can remember.
Oh, that's great. And you've always been good with kids. I still remember you coming to our house with my little boy and holding him up so we can make a basket.
We had fun that night.
Yeah. Great stuff. Tell me a little bit about how, you know, growing up, your background with the family, and growing up in the church. How has that affected who you've become and how you're able then to interact and navigate your way through the world you're in?
Well, so my parents are my two heroes in life, okay? I have 9 brothers and sisters, and we grew up in California. And my father's from Salt Lake, Dwayne Madsen, and my mom, Erlynn Madsen, is from Long Beach. They met at BYU on a blind date. And, you know, the one thing with my parents, they love to have fun. You know, my parents are very fun-loving. They love to joke with people. But if one of us kids does something that's wrong, you know, they're going to have deep conversations. You know, it's going to be, we're going to converse about it. We're going to talk about it. And, you know, hey, sometimes those conversations, you know, I mean, hey, when you mess up, your parents are there to help correct you. And I remember one time, you know, my parents really have always tried to have a family scripture study. And, you know, sometimes it happened almost every day. Sometimes it didn't, but the effort was always there. And one time my mom was saying, hey, look, I think she shared something from Abraham, the Old Testament about Abraham. And Carrie, you'll know off the top of your head, but I think it was something where God said to Abraham, hey, you know, I'm happy with you because you'll command your children to keep the commandments. You'll invite them to keep the commandments, you know. And that's one thing I can definitely say about my parents is they have always, you know, invited us, you know, told us, you know, helped us to keep the commandments. And guess what? When we've messed up, when we made mistakes, they're there to help us through that too. And there's been both.
That's great. And I know, I think you sometimes come and help your parents with, they have a farm or a garden or something.
Yeah. Yesterday. Saturday, you know, my brother and my dad and mom have just started a beekeeper operation where they're wanting to keep some honeybees. And so I helped a tiny bit with that. But it is fun that my parents enjoy agriculture, and it's fun to help them sometimes.
And it seems to me they must have somehow invested in you a hard work ethic. I know that's one of the things that you've been known for. A lot of I'll paraphrase from various places that I know have said you're one of the hardest working, and the hustle is the word that's used with you a lot. And your 8 years in the league, that you're just hardworking and hustler.
I appreciate it, Kerry, and that's a kind compliment. I think there's two kinds of hard work in the NBA. There's hard work when you step onto the court, giving it your all, okay? That is a strength of mine, okay? There's another type of hard work that I hope will become a strength. That type of hard work is the hard work of preparation. And I've had many teammates that really set the standard there of, you know, spending extra 2 hours working on their jump shot, spending an extra half an hour in the weight room. You know, that's the type of hard work that goes hand in hand with preparation that I have a lot of room to grow in, and that, you know, Kevin Garnett was one of the best at that. Kobe is one of the best at that. And it's ironic that those two guys are two of the best players in the NBA.
Or ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, great. Tell me a little bit about I have two more things I'd like to ask you, Mark. I know one is, you know, growing up in a family that was as large as yours. Certainly you have to think about the family, and yet you have to think about yourself. And I would guess that being on a team is the same thing. You have to think about what you need to do, but that team versus individual dynamic. Talk about that, if you would.
You know, growing up, I honestly feel this way, you know, that, you know, and I haven't always been able to do it like this. But if someone in my family, if my parents need me to do something, if a sibling really needs help, I honestly feel that if you do that, all the list of things you have to do, you'll be able to get it done at some point in some way. And so I believe that with all my heart. I believe that's the same on a team. You know, if you can really try to understand what the issues are, the team as a whole will perform better. You know, if you can, everyone be on the same page.
That's great. Tell me a little bit, and we've talked about this a little bit already, but again, I'm sure that there are various personalities, and it's a game full of adrenaline and working hard and pushing and bumping, and so that will introduce conflict. And then, as I've said, you're already so gifted in getting along with people. I imagine it takes some creativity in working with personalities as well, and that's a gift you have. But talk about those things, if you would.
Kerry, one of the greatest things that – one of the big blessings of the NBA is this, okay? Growing up Mormon, in my mind, it was always, hey, turn the other cheek. You know, if someone is mean, be nice back. And there was a lot of scriptures that reinforced that. And so that was always my paradigm. In college, that was fine. You know, in high school basketball and college basketball, it worked. The NBA – and let me reiterate – every guy I've played with in the NBA is an awesome, great guy, okay? But it's a physical sport. It's a tough sport. I got to the NBA, and I remember the first incident when I was dealing with someone that was really going at me, you know? And I thought, turn the other cheek, be nice.
On court or off court?
On the court, off the court, verbally, everything.
So he was going after you everywhere?
A little bit, consistently every day. And the nicer I was, I think the more he probably sensed, oh, you know, I can do this. I can continue to do this. And it got to the point where I didn't know what to do because I felt like I didn't feel like it was good. And I thought, well, do we fight? You know, is that the answer? And I talked to my dad about that. My dad said, no, you don't want to fight. The fighting's not going to do anything. And I, you know, it sounds so funny talking about it, but, you know, ultimately I just went to him and we had a conversation, you know, and I went to him several times. And it's interesting because there is a scripture in the New Testament, I don't know where it is. You'll know exactly where it is, Kerry, but it basically says, if any man hath aught against thee, go to him and reconcile. Right. I think it says, and then you'll have a brother. He'll become a brother to you.
Good, yeah.
Is that roughly it?
So, yeah, Sermon on the Mount, you talk about that, yes.
Yeah, you talk about that. And that's one of the few spots in scriptures where it talks about really addressing a problem, to me, and I'm sure you come up with a lot more. And so this was such a great gift to me because, you know, it's okay to address a problem. If there is an issue, if someone does something to me I don't like that's messed up or whatever, I'm allowed to be a little bit upset. And I'm allowed to go to him in peace and say, hey, look, when X, Y, and Z happened, it really made me upset. I don't like that. I don't like such and such. And I believe that you and I have a great relationship. It can be even better. But I do have to let you know that I don't react well to X, Y, or Z. And, you know, that one thing has been such a – it has helped my life so much. Because a lot of the times, maybe half the time, the player had no idea what it was. The person had no idea. The other half the time, the player will say, you know what? Yeah, I messed up and I apologize. And then you kind of forget about it and you move on. And that relationship is better because then the guy knows if there's an issue, we're going to talk about it. And so that to me is one of – and this might not be scriptural or whatever, but I do think it's okay. If something bad happens, it's okay to be fired up, but it's not okay to hold a grudge. It's okay to be mad. It's okay to be upset for a little while, you know, but calm yourself down. And the real thing is you got to approach the person and try to get on the same page.
I think the Lord tells us that in the Doctrine and Covenants as well. So well said.
Maybe it's not okay to be mad. Maybe that's not scriptural, but that's how I feel sometimes. Because sometimes, you know, hey, even the Savior got mad sometimes. So if he can get mad, I mean, we don't want to allow people, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah. We're good. Let me ask you one other question I have to ask. You know, we'll hear in General Conference all the time analogies. Now, President Ukdorf is currently struggling to come up with something that's aviation, he told us. But lots of times we hear sports analogies. Maybe you can just close by telling us something you've learned. You've just told us something along those lines, but maybe a sports analogy or something you've learned that can apply to all of us as we try to be better Mormons or Latter-day Saints.
Well, and I appreciate the question, Carrie. And it's funny because, you know, I almost never use sports analogies because, you know, I'm one of 10 kids in my family and some love sports and some do not like sports. Yeah. And so I never want to use a sports analogy because they might be into art. They might be into not something other than sports. But an analogy would – I mean, the biggest – one thing that I have learned in basketball is, hey, I had a coach in L.A., Tex Winter, and he used to always say this. He used to say, keep trying. Because everything can change on a trifle. And, you know, I love that statement because sometimes in a game of basketball, things are going terribly. It seems like the world's caving in. Then if you hang in there, if you keep trying, all of a sudden, it just changes. And you don't really know why. And so I think that is an analogy for life that I can apply to my own life of, hey, if things aren't working out right, if things are going the way you don't want them to go, keep trying because everything can change on a trifle. Yeah.
Well said. Thank you very much, Mark.
It's
been good to
Carrie.
Be with you.
This has been fun. It's always a great day when we get to reunite and see each other, you know.
Yeah, it is.
We'll get you out to Minnesota sometime, you and your wife.
Sounds good.
It's interesting talking about sports with you, Carrie, because and one question I've honestly had is, did the ancient Egyptians play sports? Did they appreciate sports? What was their disposition to sports?
You know, well, we know that they liked lots of different kinds of games. And some games we can find – the sports, all we can find are what we have from text, pictures, and archaeology. It doesn't leave too much for us. They may have had all sorts of sports we don't know about. But the ones we know about were typically related to making you better in warfare or better in life. So, you know, hunting and fishing sports, not just the hunting and fishing, but things that would prepare you for that. Wrestling, they were actually really, really into wrestling. We have lots of pictures of practicing wrestling. Archery was a really big one, things with spears or javelins, this kind of a thing. One of the pharaohs was just always happy to brag about how he could shoot an arrow further than anyone else and threw more brass shields than anyone else and that kind of thing.
Was that true? Could he outdo everyone else?
As far as we can tell, I mean, pharaohs always could outdo everyone else as far as we can tell. But he very well may have. This particular pharaoh, Amenhotep II, was a very warlike pharaoh and really was into it. So, and in many ways, it strikes me the same way as you were talking about earlier, that those who were very, very good, part of the reason they were good is because they had a drive and they felt like they were very, very good.
Yeah.
In order to be that good, they had to believe they could do anything and then they had to have the drive to get better at it. Yeah. I think that comes to play in all sorts of things in life. I don't know. What have you found about sports and the way it, we can see there's some Egyptian characteristics there. I think there's some characteristics about societies that you could tell from how we do sports in America and how that plays in on life.
I mean, the biggest thing that comes to my mind, like you just mentioned, is that confidence is huge. and confidence waxes and it wanes. And I've heard great players say that. You know, I've seen some of the greatest players will say that. Sometimes your confidence is so big, it's bigger than life. And sometimes it diminishes into almost nothing. And you got to find a way. When that confidence meter goes the other way in sports, you got to find a way to get it back up to full speed.
Mm. That's great. That's one of the things I think is nice about the gospel, because in the mundane world, our confidence can wax and wane, but we can always have confidence in Christ. And that's a great solace for us. But
definitely.
Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Kerry.
You've been listening to Everything Creative, an interview between Kerry Mulestein and Mark Mattson.